You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Kim Hahn. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, August 23rd, 2018.
Every time we go, the leading edge has receded not just feet or yards, but hundreds of yards.
The Arctic is warming much faster than any other place on Earth. In today's feature report, IU Environmental Sciences professor Dr. Jeffrey White talks about his Arctic research and observations. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up later in the program, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks area residents, what would you change about Bloomington? That's coming up on Voices in the Street, but first, your daily headlines.
President Donald Trump will make a trip to Evansville next week. The president is holding a rally next Thursday to stump for Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun. Trump and Vice President Mike Pence held a rally for Braun in May in Elkhart. Braun beat out two Indiana congressmen for the Republican Party's Senate nomination in a campaign that garnered national headlines for its divisiveness. Braun has since taken to attacking Democratic Senator and incumbent Joe Donnelly for his brother's alleged manufacturing ties to Mexico. An Associated Press article today alleges that much of Braun's own car parts brand is itself made in China. In the report today, AP alleges Promax, the millionaire businessman's automotive parts brand, has repeatedly worked with the manufacturer Weston. Weston allegedly outsources manufacturing to China and Taiwan, often at the expense of American jobs. The issue of safeguarding domestic manufacturing against the global market was a national elections issue in 2016. Then-candidate Donald Trump campaigned on saving the jobs of workers at Indianapolis manufacturer Carrier. Trump went on to win Indiana by 16 points. Next week's rally is President Trump's first visit to Evansville since 2014.
Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly was on the floor of the U.S. Senate today to speak on behalf of a government funding bill. Donnelly voiced his support for the Senate appropriations bill. In particular, Donnelly spoke about the importance of funding programs in the federal departments of Health and Human Services and the Department of Labor. Donnelly pointed to programs addressing toxic heavy metal pollution in predominantly African American communities in Northwest Indiana.
Last week, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, also known as ATSDR, held a community meeting in East Chicago, Indiana, to discuss the ongoing impacts of lead exposure in particular neighborhoods built over an old United States Steel lead smelter. At the meeting, ATSDR released a report that indicated in these neighborhoods, 30% of children tested between 2005 and 2015 had blood lead levels above the CDC's reference level. That's 12 times higher than the national average of 2.5%.
Donnelly says he supports the latest Senate appropriations bill because of its financial expansion to support programs for those who may be exposed to toxic heavy metals. Donnelly also proposed an amendment to fund the implementation of a law to help diagnose cancer clusters called Trevor's Law.
For the community of Franklin, Indiana, in Johnson County, Trevor's Law is a type of federal support they need today as they work with the state to seek answers to reports that nearly 50 children have been diagnosed with various types of cancers in the last 8 years. Unfortunately for these families, many of whom I've had the privilege and opportunity to get to know, Trevor's Law has not yet been implemented. That's why I'm offering a simple amendment. It provides $1 million to fund the implementation of Trevor's Law.
The Senate Appropriations Bill for 2019 is part of the Omnibus Spending Bill, which allocates money to the federal government's departments and services.
Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson announced the state will furnish $7.5 million to enhance election security this fall. The announcement comes after a Federal Election Assistance Commission released a report on Tuesday detailing state allocation of federal election security dollars. Earlier this year, Congress approved $370 million for states to use on elections and voter security. Secretary of State spokesman Valerie Warchaw says beyond the increasing funding for voter security, her office is partnering with Ball State University to educate elections supervisors.
Elections are administered in the counties by the county clerks who are elected officials. But when you're an elected official, you come from a lot of different backgrounds, and you don't necessarily have training in all of these areas. So the goal of this program out of Ball State is to educate those who want to be election administrators in the county and to give them the tools that they need.
The Certificate in Election Administration, Technology and Security, or CEATS, was developed by Ball State's Voting System and Technical Oversight Program. That program aims to educate elections officials across the state on election security, voting systems, and information technology. This is the first year of the program, and of Indiana's 92 counties, 21 county elections officials will participate in the election security program, including Brenda Woods of Brown County. The first cohort begins their education on Monday.
Business owners on Bloomington's west side are concerned about the impact of a new road that will connect Vernal Pike to Gates Drive. In their meeting on Wednesday morning, Monroe County commissioners heard appeals from several businessmen for more communication about the project. Public Works Director Lisa Ridge told commissioners the county was awarded a little over $7 million for construction of the project in 2022. In presenting the design contract for their approval, she explained the project's timeline includes public input.
Following the timeline for NDOT, they administrate our projects. We're the owner of the project, but they help administrate and make sure that we follow the federal guidelines on the building of it and the timeline and design standards. After we get this contract executed, then we will start the design process, and during that process we will meet with the property owners, discuss their needs, their business needs, so we can build that into the design so we have less impact on the businesses.
Local business owners Garrett and Jan Heitink told commissioners they're concerned the new road will restrict their plans to expand their business on Sunrise Greeting Court.
You know, we just want to make sure that there is dialogue with the owners before the design is actually done, not that we're being reactionary to the design, so to speak. Again, we're definitely not opposed to the road at all.
Scott Lieberman of Central Supply Company echoed his neighbor's interest in being part of the design discussion. Cyclist Greg Alexander brought forward a different concern. He said the new connector won't be safe for cyclists unless they're considered in the design project. He lobbied for wider lanes and a speed limit under 45 miles per hour on the new connector road. He also referenced deaths that have occurred along neighboring Curry Pike in recent decades.
People will go 45. They have just come off of Curry Pike, where they have been killing pedestrians, and they are going to go 45 on a 12-foot lane, 45 miles an hour. The design speed is 35, but they will go 45. Lots of traffic will. That will not make a safe environment for cyclists and pedestrians. We have to cross the road. We can't cross the road safely at 45 miles an hour. At 10 feet, it is positively claustrophobic. Drivers will come here and complain to you, but they will drive slower. They will see oncoming trucks and oncoming traffic, and they will be terrified for their lives, and they will go slower. And it's not actually more dangerous. It's much safer because they go slower. They have more time to think about it. If you hit a pedestrian at 25 miles an hour, they will probably live. And if you're traveling 25 miles an hour, you probably won't hit them.
Public Works Director Lisa Ridge tried to reassure the concerned citizens they'll have input through public hearings at a later date. She reiterated that the public hearings are in fact required in order for the county to receive the state funding necessary to construct the project. But she insists the design contract is the first step to get the ball rolling.
The road has not been designed. I mean, I can't stress that enough, that it has not been designed. Everything that's out there is conceptual, but we have to get to this point of getting a contract to start the design, to start discussions for the development process. We're not keeping anything from anybody. We want to have less impact on businesses as possible. The more impact you have on a business, the more cost that is added to the project. That's the last thing that we want.
The Monroe County Redevelopment Commission approved the design contract last week. Commission member Jim Shelton said the connector road is badly needed, and not just to alleviate current traffic conditions. Cook's expansion into the former GE plant is expected to put more Cook employees on the West Side roads.
The reason we need this road is that, as Jeff McKim refers to this area, it's the economic engine, or one of the economic engines for Monroe County. It right now has very bad traffic problems with the city and NDOT connecting Vernal Pike to 17th Street. We have another way to get into that area without having to go down either State Road 48 or Curry Pike, both of which are severely taxed right now. The problem with that is to get from Vernal Pike right now, you've got to go to Curry Pike. And so our goal that we've been working on now for a couple of years, really, is to connect Vernal Pike into the Whitehall Crossing area, the old ABB site, without having to get out to Curry.
Road construction on the Vernal Pike connector is not expected to begin before 2022.
Global warming is reducing crop yields in Indiana. According to a recent report from the Purdue Climate Change Research Center, warmer overnight temperatures have reduced crop yields by 2%. For Indiana's $31 billion agricultural sector, that 2% equals $620 million. The Purdue Climate Change Research Center's latest report estimates Indiana's corn yields will reduce by 20% by the year 2050. The study also predicts a 9 to 11% decline in soybean yields by mid-century. According to the Purdue report, Indiana residents can expect shorter and milder winters across the state, but wetter springs will limit the extent of the growing season. The center also estimates that global climate change will negatively impact livestock and poultry. Hotter summers are expected to increase the fatalities of animals at confined feeding operations. Free-range beef, pork, and poultry is expected to face decreased foraging options as plants grow less fibrous. The Purdue Climate Change Research Center's full study is available on their website, ag.purdue.edu.
Tick-borne diseases continue to rise in Indiana. According to the Indiana State Department of Health, more than 100 cases of tick-borne diseases have been reported in the state since January. Ticks are capable of carrying a number of diseases, including Lyme disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and ehrlichiosis. Although the ISDH states that deaths from the illness are rare, at least one person has died from ehrlichiosis in Indiana this year. Four deaths in the state, including the one this year, have been attributed to the disease in the past 5 years. The ISDH is warning Hoosiers to take steps to prevent infections due to tick bites. They advise residents to wear light-colored, long-sleeve shirts and pants when in densely wooded areas and to use insect repellents to keep the ticks away. The ISDH also recommends that pet owners perform daily checks on cats and dogs to prevent them from spreading the insects. Symptoms of a tick-borne disease can include, but are not limited to, a red rash near the bite site, headaches, muscle or joint pain, and fever. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Carolyn Vandeweel.
Support for WFHB is provided by attorneys Eric Slotograph and Ben Neoff. Slotograph Neoff is located at 200 East 3rd Street in downtown Bloomington, assisting families and small businesses in meeting the legal challenges of life, providing estate planning and wills, as well as family law services. More information is available at 812-332-6000 or at slotographlegal.com. Slotograph Neoff, law for business, community, and life.
The Earth's Arctic is warming 2 to 4 times faster than the rest of the world. IU Environmental Sciences Professor Dr. Jeffrey White researches the effect of human activities on the Earth's ecosystems. In today's featured report, Dr. White speaks with WFHB's Norm Hawley about his research in the Arctic.
It's Norm Hawley for WFHB, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Jeff White. He is at SPIA at IU. He is an expert on the Arctic. Would you explain to our listeners what your research is intended to accomplish?
Yes. Well, thanks, first of all, for inviting me to participate in your program. My research program is focused on how the Arctic landscape is responding to the rapid warming that's occurring there, because that's a critical piece of the larger set of challenges, questions that we face regarding future climate on Earth. When we think about climate, Earth's climate, it's hard to imagine that that what happens in the Arctic actually affects the entire planet climate system, but it's in fact the case. There's lots of ways that those effects play out. One that I think many of your listeners would understand is that when snow and ice comes and goes, it changes the reflectivity of Earth, and so that affects the Earth's heat budget. So the more reflective the Earth's surface is, the less of the sun's energy is captured, and more is reflected back to space. It's called albedo. And that's a big part of Earth's energy budget, which drives its climate. One phenomenon, one that I do not directly study, is the changing coverage of the Earth by ice and snow. That is happening fairly rapidly, that snow and ice cover is decreasing as the systems warm in the Arctic. And they, as I said, affect the energy budget by decreasing the reflectivity of the Earth's surface, more energy is absorbed. But they're also affecting sea level rise. Specifically, the large ice sheets that are land-bound ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet in the northern hemisphere and the Antarctic ice sheet in the southern hemisphere. Those two are in a process of melting. This is net loss of ice, and that water that's melted from those ice sheets moves ultimately to the ocean and leads to ocean sea level rise. So there are two components to sea level rise. One is the addition of water that's coming from these ice sheets, and the other is just thermal expansion. When water warms, it takes up greater volume. So both of those are contributing to the sea level rise that we're currently seeing, and which is projected to continue to accelerate. My research is actually focused on the non-ice-covered portions of the Arctic. I'm interested in how, as permafrost thaws in these Arctic landscapes, there's carbon stored in those soils, in these frozen soils, which becomes activated as those soils warm, and that organic material that's stored in those soils has the potential to be decomposed to carbon dioxide and methane. Both are strong greenhouse gases. So one could imagine that if that carbon begins to get converted from soil carbon to atmospheric CO2 and methane, those greenhouse gases could add to a multiplying effect of the warming on Earth. So that is kind of a nutshell description of the work that I'm doing. So the modeling community is trying to improve their descriptions of the drivers of climate and be able to more effectively predict future climate conditions. One of the components of the models, which is not well developed, is incorporating this conversion of stored carbon in permafrosts soil and on these landscapes, incorporating the rate of conversion of that to greenhouse gases. The global circulation models, these larger components of the climate system are better well-known, well-constrained, but right now the current climate models don't have the feedback that I described, and it's not there because they don't have enough information to be able to include those in a mathematical way. So what our results are helping them to do is develop actual components to their models that would incorporate these effects in being able to quantify future carbon dioxide, future methane, and future temperature conditions as the Arctic warms. So it's called a positive feedback loop. The warming generates more greenhouse gases, which begets more warming, and so you have this multiplier phenomenon. And as I said, currently the models don't have much in them to incorporate those effects.
I'd like to ask you about whether there are any methane hydrates actually on land underneath, say, the Greenland ice sheet. Is there enough pressure there to form those and they're retained in the soil, or are there no methane hydrates land-based?
I don't think that the methane hydrate story is at all a significant land mass issue. These are typically associated with the deeper ocean sediment environments. The soil thickness in much of the Arctic is not sufficiently large. There's, you know, significant bedrock below. Even though they're permafrost and frozen year-round to great depths, hundreds of meters, you know, the soil system is not all that well-developed. It's not that deep in most places. So much of the hydrates are stored in these deeper ocean sediments, and some of them have destabilized to release methane to the atmosphere through the bubbles that are released coming up through the water column and then entering the atmosphere. And that's a whole other story. That's not research that I do, but there are certainly people studying using acoustical systems, trying to determine where those deposits are, and then trying to study how stable or unstable they are in changing ocean conditions.
Let me ask you.
And that was IU Environmental Sciences Professor Dr. Jeffrey White discussing climate change in the Arctic.
Support for WFHB comes from MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar powered generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
And up next, our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
Summer is here, the weather is beautiful, and yet there is always something one wishes for. This week on Voices in the Street, if you could change one thing in the state of Indiana, what would it be?
I wish you weren't 200 years back because of the fact that we're such a conservative state. So like the whole like legalizing marijuana and stuff, how much that could help our state out just in general. And also the fact of like, I wish you were more of like a Democratic state than a Republican state. You know, less conservative, more liberal. It's just because Indiana's just such an awful place sometimes, man.
If I was to change one thing about Indiana, I think that more people need to visit Indiana because I love Indiana and I'm very happy here. I did not grow up here and I moved here and decided to stay here from out of state. And so I think that more people need to come here and actually see what the state has to offer and all the good things about Indiana. And then I think a lot of public opinion would change about the state once they actually see how great it is.
how Republican it is.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Definitely. Is that too blunt?
I wish that everyone was more for, like, equality and, like,
the environment. Senses,
the environment.
The government. It's always been not the best while I've lived here. And I've lived on the East Coast, and it's so much more conservative, not in this town specifically. This is a very liberal town, obviously. But it's not the best. I wish we could just get everybody together and change it, because it's...
I guess it would be to have them expand health care. Because I have an older daughter who needs health care, and I don't like the way they continually threaten to change the HIP program.
I guess Bloomington, I would just say the homeless population. I mean, not change it, but, you know, be more accommodating and fix that agenda. And instead of, you know, just shifting them, find a solution rather than just a temporary Band-Aid on a bullet hole.
I'd lower property tax.
The diversity. I think more people should come here.
Be more forward-thinking. Just think that we tend to be in Indiana a little too stuck in our ways and resistant to change and taking on new innovative solutions to problems.
Construction.
Yeah, construction is stupid. And making weed legal.
I guess I would change the fact that it's mainly a red state. You know, I don't like living in a state that contributes to such a nasty political agenda.
Public health. I mean, I see here, well, on Kirkwood, there used to be a lot of homeless people. I know the opioid epidemic is really big. And, I mean, changing public health would impact safety. And
maybe the Sunday liquor law. Because we have a industry in this state of winery, small winery folks, and I think it would help them, although they can sell on Sunday, but you know, other places ought to be able to sell on Sunday too.
It's politics. Just way too conservative. They need to be a little bit more liberal on some things. I'm conservative, but sometimes you have to be a liberal on certain items.
Oh, I'd like to have I think the issue with gerrymandering. I think we need districts that actually are competitive and give the people a say. Well, it gives the people a say. Right now, it's just if the only competition is in essentially the Republican primary, you've just got a tendency to go ever further to the right.
Probably legalize marijuana because it would help our economy and keep people out of the system who don't belong in the system.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Norm Hawley.
Voices in the Street was produced by Barbara Von Provosky. Our engineer today is Dan Withard. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Kim Hahn.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Big Talk with Michael Glab, a WFHB news and public affairs program highlighting the issues, events, and people in South Central Indiana. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at WFHB.org and catch live broadcast of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.